you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. You're about to hear the continuation of the epic Romano-Saxon War by Josh Hutchins. This is the audio version of our first Twilight Histories book, written by Josh Hutchins. If you're enjoying this series, I highly recommend you pick up the book. And now, on to the story.
We row for hours. Well, they row for hours. I just say row for hours. When the storm subsides to the point where we are no longer in imminent life-threatening danger, we pull in the oars and collapse to the deck, exhausted. Except Glycerin. At sea, he doesn't seem to require sleep at all. Maybe he was born to be a pirate. Praxos nudges me from my sleep. The last vestiges of my warm dreams slip away. I wipe the crud from my eyes and see the sun is low in the sky, casting a long beam of light on the surface of the sea. "We're still alive," I say. "There must be a more severe punishment waiting for us in Saxony." I look up at Praxos. "Why is it always you who wakes me up?" He shrugs.
"It's morning. Are you hungry?"
I sit up and survey the boat. "Where is she?"
"I'm right here," Hecate says, taking a seat next to me.
"Great." I roll my eyes and settle back down. I was concerned. You may have jumped or fallen overboard last night."
"Such genuine concern," she smirks. "Now, I'm going to look at your arm."
She starts to pull at the bandage, but I pull away. No, thank you. Glycerin already looked at it."
"He did he? And what medical knowledge do you think he possesses?"
I open my mouth, but no sound escapes. So I just hold out my arm to her. I see the faintest smile on her face. "I don't know why you think this is funny."
"I'm sorry," she says, frowning again. "I only want to help."
She slowly unwraps the bandage from my forearm, giving the bandage a grimace.
"Looks like this bit of cloth from my robe is ruined."
"How thoughtless of me. I'm sorry I didn't consider how the loss of my arm would impact your wardrobe."
"I forgive you," she says, ignoring my annoyance.
The wound is caked with crusty red blood and pus. A network of thin red lines extends down my arm about 3 inches. Hecate and I glance at each other. She leans overboard and returns with a small cup of seawater, which she then douses my arm with. My skin turns to fire and ice. The pain is so overwhelming, I lose all sense of myself for many seconds. She holds my arm firmly, staring at me with eyes that don't seem to give a damn.
What did you do that for?" "Relax, apprentice," she says quietly. "I've seen worse wounds healed because they were rinsed with salt water, so I've done the same with yours."
She wraps a fresh, clean bandage around my arm. Hecate holds out a shapely leg, newly revealed due to a patch of missing cloth.
"Can you warn me next time?"
She says nothing. Thank you, I say. She winks.
You're welcome.
I sigh and try to get comfortable. A few crewmen manage the sail and the rigging, with Glycerin directing them. One of the other men sits at the steering board.
God, does that man never rest?
Hecate settles in nearby, watching the horizon. The sea isn't quite a sheet of glass, but it's as smooth as I've ever seen it. Hey, I say quietly to her. Earlier you mentioned that you had a son once. What was his name? She slowly turns her head to glare at me.
This is how you thank me? By asking me about my dead son? What kind of sick peasant are you?
I'm sorry, I was only wanting to know more about you, that's all. We stare into the distance. I hear her breathing, and she tightens her lips.
His name was Titus. He never lived outside my body. When I birthed him, his body was pale blue and gray. His joints were stiff, and he was curled into a tiny sphere.
She wipes one of her eyes with the back of her hand.
But he never had to learn of the cruelty of his father, the weakness of his mother, or the evil world into which he was born.
She looks at the sky, streaked with pastels.
He is in heaven right now, watching us. I'm certain of it.
She moves to the front of the boat and sits alone, facing the sea. Nobody says much for a few days. We simply let the wind and the sail push us eastward. Past midday on what must be the sixth or the seventh day, a foggy landmass pokes over the horizon. So, is this where we are supposed to be? I ask. Kindheart, Glycerin, and Praxos each exchange a vacant look. Great poker face, guys. Just great.
Too early to tell for sure,
Kindheart answers in his accented Latin.
We move closer. I believe we are in the right place.
A ship!
A man at the prow shouts. The entire crew stands at once, trying to see over the curve of the horizon and through the misty air.
That's a Saxon ship,
Glycerin says, shading his eyes with his hand. Will they be friendly? I ask, as we all turn to look at Kindheart. He shrugs, then seems to notice our concern.
I am not sure. I was concerned this may happen. What?
Praxos says. Well, unless we go back out to sea, we cannot avoid that ship. They're between us and the shoal, Glycerin says. And I'm certain this is where we wanted to go. As we all stand there on the ship, quiet, we hear the distant sound of men chanting and rowing, the faint bump of wooden oars against the wooden hull of their ship.
Any brilliant ideas, apprentice?
Praxos asks. I guess we wait and hear what they have to say, I answer. Just keep your eyes open. I don't think we have the manpower to hold them off. We watch the boat slowly make its way towards us. Even though a stout wind pulls us to the east, they quickly close within 10 yards. They make no motions or gestures at attacking us.
Welcome,
a man says, one foot propped on the side rail of his ship. He's clad in thick leather, covering most of his body. His head is crowned with a mop of golden hair, falling past his shoulders in long tresses.
Thank you, Kindheart replies. We wish to come ashore and trade.
The man seems to recoil.
Kindheart, is that you?
He does a quick survey of our crew,
Where is the rest of the raiding party? Have you returned with gold? Cattle? Women? Who are these people you sail with? Romans?
He leans back slightly, just enough to place a hand on the pommel of a weapon at his side. Just relax, I say, showing him the palms of my hands.
Who are you?
He squints, then turns to Kindheart.
Does this fool speak for you now, Kindheart?
Fool? That seems a bit harsh, I say.
Apprentice,
Praxos says to me quietly,
I cannot tell exactly what you are saying, but I think this may not be the best time to assert yourself.
I frown at him.
You may want to put your Roman dog on a leash, Kindheart, lest I deal with him myself.
I hold my breath, and Kindheart holds out a calming hand to me.
Why are you here?
I was defeated on the island of Britannia. The men entrusted to me, they remain on the island. These men here helped me escape.
Kindheart holds out a hand towards the rest of us.
And one woman,
the man says, a thin smile erecting itself on his lips.
You may pass on to the shore, if you leave her here with us.
He points with a calloused finger. I don't think you can handle her, I say. He looks at me, then turns back to Kindheart.
If your dog barks again, I'll rip out his tongue.
I'd like to see you try that.
Apprentice, you are not helping,
Kindheart says. Nobody speaks for several seconds. Only the gentle lapping of small waves against the hulls of our two ships. The man snorts a laugh.
You're not worth my time, dog.
You can't have any one of our crew.
We will have your woman, or you will not make it to land alive.
I see Hecate take an involuntary step backwards. I level a glare at the man. Then you'll have to go through me first.
This could be arranged,
he says, then steps back and jerks his arms in the air.
The plank,
he bellows. They begin maneuvering their boat closer. Then two men lay a broad oaken board across the gap between the two ships.
What is happening?
Praxos asks. I get the sense something bad is about to happen. Would that be an accurate statement, apprentice? Glycerin says, inclining his head at me.
The apprentice has challenged him to a contest. They will now fight on the plank,
Kindheart says.
What is with you, apprentice? Why are you always challenging people to a fight?
Praxos says.
Oy, the plank,
Glycerin moans, his hand on his forehead, his eyes closed. I haven't challenged anyone until now. That thing with Kindheart was his idea, remember? I jerk my head at our Saxon shipmate. Praxos looks at Kindheart, who only shrugs. Besides, I continue, I didn't actually challenge this guy. I simply insulted him. Glycerin rolls his eyes.
How do you plan to fight him with one arm, apprentice?
Praxos asks, pointing sharply at the bandages I wear. I'm right-handed. He massages his temples.
This is insanity, apprentice. Glycerin and I risked our lives to bust you out of Thorium's jail. For what? To watch you get killed by some nameless fishing boat captain within view of the Saxon shore?
Do you have a better idea?
They will not let us go to shore unless Apprentice fights him,
Kindheart says flatly. Is that all that happens? Glycerin asks.
Well, no. They'll probably board us, take our boat and our supplies, rape Hecate, and throw the rest of us into the sea. Actually, they'll probably rape us too.
There's a general grimace amongst the entire crew. Praxos exhales, then reaches into his cloak.
Here,
he says, handing me a thick knife.
Use this. For fighting on a boat, it's better than a large sword.
The Saxon, of the other boat, stomps one foot on the plank with a heavy thunk.
Egric!
He shouts, pounding his chest a half dozen times with his fist. I cautiously place a bare foot on the plank. Glycerin and Praxos give me wary looks as I swing my arms to maintain balance. The crew of the other boat laughs. Egric turns and raises his arms, trying to incite the crew to more laughter, when I drop the knife into our boat and launch myself at him. One lunge is all it takes to wrap my arms around his waist, painful as it is on my injured arm. I hear his knife clatter on the plank just as his head thuds against the side of the boat, right at the waterline. The dark underneath of the ocean surges upwards, bubbles trailing from Egret's nose and mouth. The familiar pressure against my eardrums. Egric is limp. I loosen my hold on him as his eyes snap open. His hand is an iron grip around my throat. I involuntarily gasp, sending up a fresh wave of air bubbles. I wrap my legs around his midsection and interlock my ankles. He burps out several bubbles and releases my neck. We sink further. My lungs are on fire. I squeeze him like a vice. He struggles. I begin frantically pulling myself upward with my uninjured arm, my left arm hanging limp at my side. The pain is too great to use it, not even now. Egric goes limp. Two oval shadows stare down at us from the surface of the water. They look like cat's eyes glaring through the murk. I gulp in new air as I breach the surface, Egric in tow. Several pairs of hands reach out and pull me into the ship. They see that I've brought Egric back with me, and they haul him aboard as well. They lay Egric on a bench. His complexion is pale, and his hair hangs to the floor like seaweed. The crew stares at the two of us with wide, shifting eyes and heavy breathing. I pull myself up and place my ear to his lips. I pinch his nose and begin blowing air into his body. After two cycles, he retches and vomits seawater like a fountain. I roll him to his side and hold his shoulder. He coughs and spits. After a minute, I slowly and carefully roll him to his back. He opens his eyes to look at me and spits again.
Why?
He asks, his voice heavy with effort. Why did I save you? I guess it's your lucky day. I reach into my belt and draw his knife, then hold it out to him, handle first. He looks at me, then at the knife. Shaking his head, he slowly takes it from me. So, do you still plan to rip out my tongue? He smiles and laughs.
I haven't decided yet.
I gingerly walk the plank back to my boat, greeted by a mixture of smiles and frowns.
That was not very honorable, apprentice,
Praxos says. Honorable? I have a hole in my arm, Praxos. He sighs. The crew of the other ship removes the wooden plank and leads our ship to a small cove where there is a smooth stone pier. Three of the men leap out of the ship and tug on thick, hempen ropes. They tie the ship to a large wooden bollard. Kindheart steps off the boat and turns to us.
Welcome to Saxony,
he says with a smile. I place a hand on the railing as I prepare to step off the ship, when I feel a soft touch.
Thank you,
Hecate whispers in my ear. so close I could feel her breath on my neck. I purse my lips and nod. She moves ahead of me and off the ship. Praxos crosses in front of me before I can take another step.
Apprentice, I have something of yours. Here.
He holds out a stone-encrusted scabbard, leather belt, and my sword! I nearly cough. How did you... Where was... He holds up a hand.
I discreetly snatched it from Thorium's audience chamber just after the guards took you away.
I pull the sword from the scabbard just enough to see the wavy lines of the blade. Then I look up at him. Why did you wait until now to give it back to me? He bats his head from side to side.
Well,
I just fought a guy on a board between two ships, Praxos. It would have been nice to have my own sword in that fight. His bottom lip protrudes very slightly.
I wasn't sure you would defeat him, and it would be a shame for such a fine blade to fall into the sea.
Thanks, buddy. Such a vote of confidence.
You couldn't even beat me, apprentice. When you fought Kynard, Hengst cheated for you. Besides, you were much better on the plank with my knife than you ever would have been with that sword. You didn't need a weapon at all.
Fine, but this is something we're going to remedy.
What's that?
He asks. My poor swordsmanship. You're going to teach me. He grimaces and smiles. And maybe his chest puffs up just a little. Then he frowns.
Why did you decide to take Egric underwater?
Well, remember those fights I told you about? The ones in a place called Vietnam, where I was locked in a cage with other people?
I remember.
You see, many of those fights were in a cage half submerged in water. We had to fight out while holding our breath. Sometimes people died in the cage. He nods.
And you were successful in these contests?
I'm still alive, aren't I? I smile. Glycerin steps off the boat, places his hands on his hips and stretches. Ah, Saxony. Just as beautiful as I left her. Beautiful enough for you to stay here and not go back to Britannia, I jest.
Oh, gods no. It's beautiful and all, and the women are soft and warm, but it's too dark. And some poor goat is always getting buggered in Germania. It ain't right.
What do you mean?
Kindheart asks. Glycerin smiles.
The Germanic people are just like everyone else, only more so. I don't know how to explain it.
Perhaps some air will help you explain better, yeah?
Egric barks in Latin.
We must speak with Wolfnoth,
Kynheart says.
Wolfnoth is dead,
Egric replies flatly.
Dead? Who sits in judgment at council?
Daragos.
Kynheart turns chalky white.
Daragos.
He says her name like he's casting a spell, reciting incantations.
Daragos,
he repeats. He turns to the rest of us with a distant look, then turns back to Egric.
We would like to eat and rest before we see Daragos.
So be it,
Egric says, holding out an arm. We follow him into a wet and dark village, full of rough-hewn stone and thatched roofs, handcarts, goats, chirping birds. A light mist has overtaken the sunshine, coating everything with innumerable tiny beads of water. The smell of earth and mildew permeate the air. I can almost taste it. We make our way to a large inn of sorts. I skip eating and soon find myself laying in a rickety wooden bed, stuffed with straw, staring blankly at the dark ceiling, letting the events of the last few days wash over me. So many questions. What is Thorium's real problem with me? He can't really think I had sex with Hecate, can he? Who burned those ships? Why did Thorium make Hengst as captain of the guard? Can I really trust Hecate? Orestes pissed off Thorium, but not enough for Thorium to have killed him right there. What really happened? What was that all about? What did Hecate whisper in his ear then? What did she whisper in his ear the day I was arrested? What's up with this Daragos lady, and why is Kindheart acting so weird about it? Will my arm heal? Am I in control of these events? Or am I just being swept along with everyone else? Do the eggheads back at Twilight Histories even know what's going on here? If I was expecting them to save me before my execution, I'd already be disappointed. I let out a breath I feel like I've been holding for some time. Moments later, I go to sleep.
Apprentice! Apprentice! Are you there?
A soft voice says to me from a distance. Prying my eyes open is like pulling apart two pieces of duct tape.
What time is it? Time? It's night time, apprentice. It's dark. That will serve, she answers.
I see Hecate's slender form emerge from the dark, shrugging off her blue shift. It whispers to the floor and out of thought. She strides to my bedside, her long hair falling to her shoulders. She places a hand on my chest and leans over me. Her lips are warm and soft. She opens her mouth and moves to straddle me, her breasts gently prodding at my chest. The thick aroma of bacon finds its way into my room and into my nose. It caresses me gently and begs me to come have my way with it. I turn to see only a small depression in the straw mattress, where Hecate had lain mere hours ago. The smell of her hair lingers on my shoulder. I rise and see there are fresh bandages on my injured arm, clean cloth of lapis blue. I flex my fingers and notice a sharp reduction in pain from yesterday. I dress myself, strap on my sword, and go downstairs.
Apprentice, over here,
Praxis says with a smile on his lips.
Another meal for our friend,
he says to a slender man in dark wool clothing. The man nods happily and turns to the rear of the room. I walk to the table where Praxos, Glycerin, Hecate, and the rest of our crew sit. It is a very large table, looking like walnut or oak. The planks are nearly 4 inches thick and 15 feet long. Glassless windows let in the light and breeze of the morning. I sit next to Glycerin, across from Hecate. Where is Kindheart? I ask.
Egret came from him earlier this morning. Apparently, we cannot go before Daragos or their council until Kindheart explains himself to them,
Glycerin says. The proprietor places a wooden tray in front of me. It's mounded over with a steaming hunk of side pork, boiled cabbage, and a thick roll of mahogany brown bread, and a tankard of ale. I look at the men.
I can't pay for this. I have no money, I say.
Egric paid, he says with a smile.
Well, I'll be sure to give Egric my thanks. I turn to Praxos. It's the least he could do. I mean, I did save his life.
After you almost killed him. So I'm not sure that counts, apprentice.
Praxos retorts with a sly grin. I shrug and eat my breakfast, all the while snatching occasional glimpses of Hecate, but I never see her looking at me. We spend the day walking around, killing time. We check on our boat. My bad, Glycerin's boat. When we're alone near the bow, Glycerin pulls me in close to him. I name the ship, Apprentice. I frown. You're naming the ship after me? Gods, no, that's not what I said. He shakes his head. I'm naming her the governor's wife. He smiles like a snake, like a fox. Sometime around midday, we eat at the same inn where we had breakfast, and Kindheart joins us. He has dark circles under his eyes, and he moves stiffly. How are you? I ask him, just before taking a large sip from my tankard. He exhales.
I am fine,
he says, rubbing his shoulder where Hink stabbed him many days ago. He sits heavily on the bench across from me.
Daragos has granted us audience. We will go to her at nightfall.
There's an awkward silence, punctuated by slurps and chewing noises. You know this lady? I ask. He does a harumph.
Yes, I know this lady. She is mother of Hinkst.
He looks up at me and stares. I take the time to chew and think before I reply. I see. I think I see. Is that little fact going to become a huge problem? He shrugs.
I do not know. I did not consider possibility that I would be asking favors from mother of man who tried to kill me.
Well, we aren't really asking her for a favor, are we? We're just letting her know that we intend to raise an army to take to Britannia, permanently, right? I still have major reservations about the idea of being a serious and intentional military commander, and even more concerned with Kindheart, Glycerin, and Praxos' willingness to go along with the idea. But I'll hold on to that argument for another time.
Yes, but she can make it difficult, or she can make it very easy.
Did you tell her that her son tried to kill you? Glycerin asks. Kindheart nods. And that he failed? Kindheart frowns.
I figure his mere presence would convey that message,
Praxos says, furrowing his brow at Glycerin. Right, Glycerin answers. Then what's the problem? I ask.
Daragos knows, as we all do, about message from Roman Emperor. Message which caused us to form a raiding party intended for Britannia. She was there when we discussed it, but she knows of another message, one received days earlier. This other message was from Governor Thorium himself. He requested we send men to the island as well. However, it is unclear to whether he wanted us to help defend against Picts to their north, or if he was simply asking us to raid Britannia. Daragos say Hinkst told her of this other message.
I look at Glycerin, who seems to notice my gaze. He holds up his hands. Honestly, I don't know anything about a second message. Truthfully. I turn to Kindheart. But why did Hinkst not tell you before? What was the purpose of...
keeping information from me?
Kindheart looks up and down the table.
I am his rival for power and influence over here. Or, I was.
And now, Hinkst is Thorium's captain of the guard. I scratch the hairs on my chin. What was the arrangement between you and him? How did you get the job of leading the raid while he played second fiddle? Second what? Lysern asks. Second in command.
I brought most people. Hengst brought second most. Simple.
Does Daragos know Hengst is now working for Thorium? That's the worm, isn't it, apprentice? How do we convince a man's mother of allowing us to go kill her son? Glycerin says. All at once we lean back from the table. Kynhar grins savagely.
Now you see the true problem here. Hengst literally stabbed you in the back, Kynhar. He has no honor,
Braxos says.
Tell that to Daragos,
Kynhar says.
She is not slobbering fool, no, but she is the mother of Hengst.
I blow out a breath of air. Okay, what happens if she opposes us? We take turns looking at each other. Okay, let me ask another question. Kynhar, you said Hengst was the bastard son of a wealthy man here. Where is he? Kynhar nearly crosses his eyes.
I think it is enough to seek permission to kill her son without asking Daragos the whereabouts of her bastard's father. One family drama at a time, please.
The path we take through the village is muddy, and we walk to the sound of squishing under our feet. The air is increasingly cool and moist. I touch the hilt of my sword. Something about that physical contact seems to calm me. My heart is racing, but I can't really say why. There's a loud shout in a low stone building as we approach it, followed by the sound of furniture being broken and cloth being ripped. Praxos and I look at each other just as two bodies spill out of the building and into the mud right in front of us. Candles cast yellow light on them. They grunt and strain. The fur-clad form on top begins pummeling the bottom one, just as a pair of bare legs wrap around him and begin squeezing.
You can't... cannot...
The man on top gasps, then falls to the side. The person on bottom pivots to the top and delivers two sharp punches to the man's nose, which responds with a splash of blood. The man gurgles and goes limp.
Don't tell me what to do. It will work.
She shouts at the man, unconscious, in a strangely baritone voice. Then he turns and looks at all of us standing around.
What? Haven't you ever seen a brawl before? Or have you just never seen a woman fight?
The form turns to me and pushes back a wad of sweaty brown hair from her face. Her blue eyes are ablaze with rage, and her red lips seem to quiver. Two purplish bruises punctuate the beauty of her cheeks. Her glare only lingers on me for a moment. Then she turns and kicks the man in the stomach, apparently for good measure, then goes back inside the building. She's greeted by a chorus.
We should keep moving,
Kynhar says, indicating the path ahead with one hand. I nod, and we trudge on, leaving the man sprawled in the mud. Our small procession lights its way with glowing orange torches. The smell of earth lingers all around us. At length we come to a circular stone building, possessing a pointed thatch roof with thick timbers protruding at the bottom. The thatch is brown and yellow, with spots of grass growing here and there. At its leather flap of an entrance stands a man holding a spear with a wolf fur draped across his shoulders.
Kynhar?
Kynhar nods, and the man gestures towards the door. The man places a hand on Kindheart's shoulder before he enters the room and looks him straight in the eyes.
I heard about your family. I'm very sorry.
Thank you. Has there been any word?
None. I don't know if Terragos has told you.
She has told me nothing. Except, both went to fight near the Rhine, and no one has returned.
Then you know as much as I do. But I was mostly speaking of Hapsa.
Kindheart nods his head sharply.
Sometimes the cold takes us. Other times it's the starvation or disease or the sword. Why it could not be old age with Hapsa, I do not know. I am sad she died before I returned.
You will see her again, Kindheart. I know it.
He smiles. With tight lips, Kindheart steps through the door. Inside, the single room is aglow with the orange light of a central fire. The acrid smell of smoke and the pungent odor of unshowered humans fills the air. My eyes begin watering, but the warmth is a welcome change. Seemingly 50 or more people line the walls, all in various stages of conversation. But that dull rumble of talking hisses to a silence as we enter. Kindheart is in front, with Praxos and me behind him. Glycerin is behind me with Hecate. A tall woman with broad shoulders stands next to the fire in the center of the room. She's the only one not looking at us. Instead, she seems lost in the flicker of the fire's flames. Her brown hair is loosely braided, and it looks to be gaining a twinge of winter at its roots on top of her head. The silence holds, and all eyes begin to focus on her. I try to take in the surroundings more thoroughly, but I can't help thinking about Kindheart's family. I mean, I never bothered to think of Kindheart's family before now, or if he even had a family at all. I have to push the entire subject out of my head for the moment. Kindheart clears his throat and starts in a Germanic tongue.
Terragos, these are my friends.
He gestures to me.
This man, you may speak in Latin. I'm sure it will be easier on our...
She smiles, but it seriously scares me. Our guests. Kindheart nods.
Very well. This is the apprentice. Glycerin... Praxos, and child murderer.
A haggard, raspy voice blasts from across the room. I jump, along with many others, and look at a short woman with hair like tumbleweed, dressed in shreds of mixed-matched animal skins. She's the Dark Age equivalent of a flood victim. She stands there, a bony finger outstretched, vacant eyes unblinking.
Is she talking to me?
Hecate whispers, pointing to herself.
Evil, wretched, foul woman. Murdered your own baby.
I notice the heads in the room turning to and fro in confusion. Baby murderer? I ask the woman, in a language which I can't recognize. Luckily, my computer chip translates it without much difficulty. Her eyes flare in surprise. Terragos snaps her head around and fixes her hawkish glare on me. The old stooped crone curls her fingers in a sinister motion, then reaches her bony finger to me, shaking.
You! Beware her! She is not what she seems. Betrayal. lies. Death. Death. Death.
Why? What has she done?
Death. Death.
Daragos points to some men near the old woman.
Please, see her outside and help her to my home.
They gently place their hands behind her arms and shuffle her to the side door. As she passes by Daragos, she reaches for her. Daragos gently grabs her hands and pats them lightly.
It will be fine. This will pass.
The woman seems satisfied and quietly leaves the room. Daragos breathes in, then turns to me, one eyebrow slightly raised. She holds her hands firmly on her broad hips.
You are apprentice, she says in Latin. Kindheart tells me you are a great commander.
My bowels turn watery, and I struggle to swallow a newly formed lump in my throat. Kindheart flatters me, Daragos. I do have a set of skills and theories and other traits which lend themselves well to military command and control, yes. Her eyes sparkle, either with wonder or terror. I can't for the life of me tell which. It dawns on me that I answered her question in that other language, so I repeat it in Latin. She seems to catch her breath, then turns back to the warmth and the glow of the fire.
Kindheart tells me the grey island, which you call Britannia, is not so grey. He tells me the island is fertile. Fertile in its soils, its rivers, in its metals, fertile in its peoples.
She knows the language, but uses a strange tempo. The words fall out of her mouth with a cadence I find difficult to follow. I look around, not knowing what to do with my eyes.
Rome has killed our peoples for centuries. They have blood debt to us. But Rome rules Grey Island no longer. We know this to be truth. If you want to go Grey Island to kill, burn, to take the women's, children's, the cattle's, then I say go. Do what you can. Kill them, rape them, slave them. Do what you will. But if you wish men of Saxony to take all land, Grey Island, bend peoples to your will and conquer Grey Island, I say no. Blood debt to Rome must be paid first. Roman blood debt cannot be paid on the Grey Island.
I don't like where this is going, mate,
Glarcerin whispers to me. She glares at each of us in turn, settling on me.
Kindheart also tells me,
she takes in a large breath,
of the treachery of my son.
Her eyes dart to Kindheart, then return to the flames.
I know what you ask of me. I know the price of treachery.
She turns away from the fire and approaches us, with her hands clasped behind her back. Her sharp beak of a nose matches the hawk-like ferocity of her eyes. There is a shuffling behind me as a woman in furs enters the room. Daragos curls her lip into a grimace, then switches back to Germanic.
When I say nightfall, Ingrid, I mean nightfall. What was it this time? Another engineering dispute at the Golden Bear?
The woman
tosses her hair over her shoulder. No, Mother. It was a mathematical dispute this time, and my discussions are always welcome at the Golden Bear. You'll be pleased to know I was right all along. When you take the number 10 and multi... Dergos holds up a hand sharply. Now is not the time. You are my daughter, and your place is here when I say. Yes, Mother. The woman moves to stand at the back of the room. Dergos turns back to me and smiles. She flicks her wrist over her shoulder. My apologies. It seems neither of my children listened to their mother. Now, where were we? You were talking about your son who tried to kill Kynhard and is now working for Thorium, the Romano-British governor in Londonium. I managed to say in total deadpan. Real smooth, apprentice. Maybe you can ask for her hand in marriage next, Glycerin whispers. I will send messengers to the Grey Island to discover the truth. If Hengst is truly who you say he is, then... She pokes her tongue into her cheek and moves it around to the other side. Then we will discuss allowing you to take army to the Grey Island. She exhales and stands more erect. Then I will allow you to kill my son. I nod slowly. What do we do until then? She raises her eyebrows and smiles. I already told you. The blood debt with Rome must be settled before you can go to the Grey Island. She looks around the room. Whatever men you can convince to fight for you, take them and punish Rome. Bring me... She pauses, her eyes narrowing. 10,000 swords of Rome. Then we will consider the blood debt paid. Then, and only then, can you take larger army to the Grey Island. I look around at Praxos and Glycerin.
10,000 swords. That is more than 2 legions. This is no small task, apprentice, Praxos says, with his lips pursed.
This is simple. We just have to locate a Roman blacksmith, Glycerin answers.
And 10,000 Roman heads to go with them, Dergos says, proving she is listening to us.
I hear Glycerin curse behind me. Praxos furrows his heavy brow, but before the two can devolve into their witty banter, I look at Hecate and gesture with my chin. And you, what do you think? It dawns on me, as I'm looking at her, that I don't know what to think about her anymore. She only shrugs and looks at the ground. Kynhard places a hand softly on her shoulder, and she reaches for it.
I think we can do this, apprentice, he says, looking at Hecate.
I turn to Praxos.
How many men will we need to kill 10,000 Romans?
Praxos frowns.
In one battle? Probably more than 50,000. No such army exists here.
Kynhard nods in agreement. What if we spread the head collection over a campaign, say, 1 year? Praxos shrugs. I turn to Dergos.
10,000 swords? And how will we transport the army to the... Grey Island once we bring you these swords?
I don't have to turn back to see them shaking their heads, but Dergos' smile is a predatory, wolf-like smile.
Then it is settled. You will settle blood debt with Rome. I will send messenger to the Grey Island to learn of my son.
What about the ships? We'll need more than one ship to transport the army to Britannia. Probably 50 or more. Dergos can't even contain her surprise.
50? Do you plan to take 5,000 men to the Grey Island?
She takes a deep breath.
The harvest is soon upon us. Then we must endure the winter. If you send me 100 swords, and 100 Roman heads by the end of winter, then I will begin construction of such a fleet of ships, but not before.
Before the end of winter? Fine. I'll get you those heads. But we'll start recruiting an army immediately, and we'll need provisions for fighting in the cold. Any boats you don't plan on using during the winter, I'd like them made available to Glycerin. We intend to use the rivers to supply them in.
Idle boats, so long as their owners don't have immediate plans for them, are yours for the winter, and I will contribute to their cause with some of my own stores. It is up to you to provide the remainder. You may yet sell more promises, apprentice, she smiles.
There's a real chance we'll be swatting a hornet's nest with Rome. If our army is defeated, Rome will probably send its legions out to punish you. Are your people really ready for that? She stands firmly and puffs out her chest, her nose naturally inclining.
We are Saxons! Proud Saxons of Germania! The time has come to push the Romans out of our lands!
I nod. How much influence do you really have here? How many towns and villages will answer our call?
That depends on you, apprentice. I think you are up to the task.
I agree, I say with a grimace. Now what? I instantly regret saying it aloud.
Now we drink,
Daragos says, her eyes twinkling again. The room erupts in cheers. I hardly notice the enormous clay chalice someone thrusts into my hands, nearly running over with a tart wine. Smiling faces everywhere. Kindheart claps me on the back and places an arm around Hecate. Daragos puts a firm hand on my neck and pulls me close to her.
My elder woman, Potsa, and I are the only people who speak the arcane tongue. Soon, I will learn how you came to know this ancient language, and I will have your thoughts on Potsa, what she told you tonight.
She leans back from me and looks down her nose into my eyes.
On the morrow, perhaps, yes?
Sure, I reply, and then proceed to get thoroughly plastered.
If you enjoyed this show, consider picking up a copy of the book on Amazon or through the website at twilighthistories.com. It's our first Twilight Histories book, and Josh has put a huge amount of effort into it, expanding the story and making sure it was edited and beta tested. It's a solid, well-crafted book, and if you enjoy listening to it, why not have it on your shelf? When you purchase it, please give it a generous rating on Amazon. This will help the book get picked up by Amazon search engines, so it will be visible to others. You can find the book on Amazon by running a search for Josh Hutchins or Romano-Saxon War, or by going to the website at twilighthistories.com. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening, and take care.